AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Welcome to the Theorist Composer Collaboration, a podcast interview series highlighting modern composers and music theorists. My name is Aaron DiZarilla. I'm the host of this podcast and also a music theorist myself. Today I'll be talking with the music theorist Danny Jenkins. Among many things, he is the president of Music Theory Southeast, editor of SMTV, and the associate dean and director of graduate studies at the School of Music at University of South Carolina, where he is also a professor of music theory. That leads me to welcome Professor Danny Jenkins himself to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi, Aaron. It's a real pleasure to be with you today.
Yes, of course. Likewise. Thank you for making time for coming on to here. It's great to talk to you. And for those who are not familiar with your background or your work, can you please introduce yourself personally, professionally, academically, whatever you choose?
Yeah, so I'm starting year 19 at the University of South Carolina. I did a PhD at the Eastman School of Music and went directly from there to South Carolina, where I still am. My background before that, my bachelor's degree is in music education, and I was a high school band director for 3 years in Kentucky, where I'm from. And then after that, I did a master's in music theory and composition at the University of Louisville, and then on to the Eastman School of Music, where I did my PhD. And in my early research career, I was really focused on 20th century music. My master's thesis is on Elliot Carter. One of my early articles is on Elliot Carter. And my dissertation was on the music of Arnold Schoenberg. And my first book was about Schoenberg's program notes and analyses of his own music. So it was really focused on 20th century music and the analysis of 20th century music. But after I got tenure, I got interested in public music theory, which I'm sure we'll talk more about today. And that's probably the area of my research profile that I'm most identified with at this point is public music theory.
You're certainly right about that, and we definitely will talk about that, but I want to take a little bit of pause too. I just want to ask, what a long and winding road to end up to music theory and public music theory. So you started with music education. What made you decide to, after your 3 years as a band director, to go back into academia and pursue a different style of avenue for music?
At the University of Kentucky, I had two really wonderful theory teachers. They're maybe not as well known in the field today because they didn't have extensive research profiles, but they were really well known at that time as pedagogues. And their names were Chuck Lord and Kate Covington. And they were just really excellent theory teachers. I learned so much from both of them. There's the anthology Music Sources, and Chuck is one of the co-authors of that anthology, so you may have known his name. You may not know Kate's name, but both of them were highly respected, I came to learn later in my career as theory pedagogues. But for me, they were just my theory teachers. And the University of Kentucky has some scholarships. They're called the McCracken Scholarships, and they're really kind of awards that are given each year. And one of them is in music theory. And I won the music theory award the year that I was up for it. I didn't even know really that this existed, but that seemed to confirm for me, I had just really enjoyed music theory class so much. And that seemed to confirm for me that maybe I was good at music theory, but beyond that, maybe that was something that I wanted to do as a profession. My middle school band director tells me that I asked her about becoming a band director. So I think I had wanted to be a band director for many years. But similarly, when I got into college and I'm, very focused on the goal of getting my bachelor's degree and becoming a band director, I think also this seed was planted about perhaps being a theory professor someday. So I took my first band directing job with the thought that I would do that for a while, but that my eventual goal was to be a music theorist. And in the state of Kentucky at that time, I don't know if it's still the case now, but you could teach for 5 years without having started your master's degree. But after 5 years, you had to have started your master's degree and you had to complete your master's degree within 10 years. It was part of the teacher professionalization in the state of Kentucky is that they wanted people to get master's degrees. So I kind of had the option of going at that education route, getting started that way. But I knew that if I wanted to be a music theorist, it wasn't a great idea to go get a master's in music education. So it kind of forced the issue. So I taught for 3 years. And then I either needed to start getting some master's credits under my belt, or I needed to move in this direction of music theory. And I also at that time was I did a lot of arranging for high school marching bands, and I did some composition, but I wasn't really sure if I wanted to do theory or composition. And University of Louisville, which was right in my back door, had a master's degree in theory and composition. So that was an excellent place for me to go and do my master's. I had an assistantship. And it was during that time that I really figured out that as much as I like composing, what I wanted to be was a music theorist. So that was how that worked out.
Fair enough. Fair enough. You see, I am just out of my master's. I'm only 23, and maybe it's just the mindset I grew up in, but I was always under the impression of if you're going to do music theory, you go and do it immediately. Over the past months of reaching out and talking directly more to music theorists and learning their personal story, the more I learned that, well, obviously, life is more complicated than that, but there's many different avenues to arrive at the field, and so that's wonderful. And so, moving forward in time, it's interesting to hear that leading up to being a professor at the University of South Carolina, your specialty, if I could say, is, and I'm going to make a big generalization in the posttonal analysis. A lot of different caveats in that. What was it while you were a professor that started to develop the interest of public music theory?
Well, it really was my work on Schoenberg that led me to public music theory. I got extremely lucky in my first year as a professor. Severine Neff and Zabina Feist were editing and still are editing a collection of Schoenberg's writings. They had someone to do the book on. They wanted a book on Schoenberg's program notes and analyses of his own music because he wrote about his own music quite a bit. And they had someone to edit that book, but life got complicated and then that person couldn't do it. And so they reached out to me and asked me if I wanted to do it, which was really lucky for me because, as I said, I was in my first year as a professor. And here's basically somebody coming and saying, "Here's an Oxford book contract. Would you like it?" And you don't have to do anything but say yes. And so, of course, I said yes. And it ended up being a really worthwhile project. But one of the things that I learned in, Schoenberg wrote, I think there's 80 distinct documents in the book. And since the book is published, I've even found more things that could have gone into the book that I didn't know about at the time. But anyway, Schoenberg wrote so much about his own music. And while some of it, he wrote for his composition students, which is a very specialized audience, He wrote a lot of things for a more general audience. He wrote program notes. He spoke on the radio about his music. He used the record jacket, the LP record jacket, as a way to communicate with audiences. He was working on a television broadcast near the end of his life. And so I was just really inspired by the idea that this modernist composer that we often associate with having extremely complex and difficult music, and it is complex and difficult, but that he was so desirous of having an audience that would understand his music and was willing to reach out and find different ways to communicate to different populations. And I just found that very inspiring. And I thought, well, he can't be the only one. Who else has done this? And I immediately thought of Leonard Bernstein. And that just then sent me down the path of, the last decade or so of my research, which has really been to celebrate the connection between music theory and broadly speaking, community, community engagement, just public engagement in the understanding of music.
Yeah, I will say, bringing it, you just brought up Leonard Bernstein. I never even thought about it necessarily in the context of public music theory, but I just remember when a handful of years, it was like beginning of undergrad, I on YouTube just by happenstance found those PBS recordings of the Concert for Young People that Bernstein did, and where he like explained modes and stuff like that. I remember at the time finding that really inspiring. I'm like, man, I want to do something like that. And so I guess there's an example of that. And I also have to say, you could probably tell from the nature of this podcast a little bit, I love it when composers talk about their own music. And while I have some opinions of Schoenberg's personality in some of those writings, which is partially amusing and partially frustrating sometimes. But aside, I love hearing the discourse created by a composer in their own writings. I did a paper in my master's just for a class. It wasn't like for a conference or anything about one of Schoenberg's lesser known students, Edward Sturman. And I read a book that was curated by his wife and daughter that was just a collection of all of his different personal writings. Fascinating. I guess that's partially inspired me to start this podcast because I started it around the time I read that book. But wonderful, wonderful. I just thought of this question, and I hope I'm going to word it correctly. But I'm thinking about when Schoenberg would have done those radio broadcasts and would have done that outreach. What is your opinion with the dueling ideology that maybe was happening after or during, I'm not sure, I don't totally remember, about someone like Milton Babbitt, someone who is a hardcore institutionalist? How do you think about the history of public music theory with that?
Yeah, well, of course. Actually, I have an article that's published in the Journal of the Arnold Schoenberg Center that I think it's titled "I Care If You Listen," which is to Babbitt's "Who Cares If You Listen," which, of course, that was not Babbitt's title. Babbitt's title was "The Composer as Specialist," but "Who Cares If You Listen" is certainly catchier, and I can understand why an editor would use that. I don't want to get into whether or not Babbitt cared if people listened to music,
Understandable, understandable.
but I do think I do think that there's an important lesson here in the development of the Society for Music Theory, and Alan Fort and Milton Babbitt being such important figures in the establishment of that organization, and that one of the things that was very important to them was that music theory would professionalize. Because you had at that point, you had composers that wrote music, and so they had creative activity that they could show as research. And you had musicologists that did either archival work or other kinds of historical musicology. And so they had research products that could be valued by the academy. But then you really had, basically theory teachers. You had people that taught solfege, or people that taught harmony. But the idea of a music theorist having a research profile, in post-World War II, in the post-World War II academy, just really wasn't a thing. And that's what one of the frustrations that Babbitt and Fort kept running up against was that they couldn't get their research accepted at the American Musicological Society. And so forming their own society, the Society for Music Theory, was this very important step in order to professionalize music theory, that there would be research, there would be journals. And of course, the Journal for Music Theory is much older than the Society for Music Theory, but there were these frustrations there and this desire to professionalize. And I think that in that desire to professionalize and in the steps that they took, they had to kind of push aside certain things that had been associated with music theory and the kind of music appreciation strain of music theory, which is something that I write about in my introductory chapter to the Oxford Handbook of Public Music Theory. That was something that they felt like they needed to de-emphasize in order to create the space for a professional music theory. And so I think that that's why for several decades, we didn't really think about public music theory as a discipline because we were trying so hard to professionalize, to create like an academic music theory. Yeah, that's, I think, the kind of, I think that the public music theory was kind of in the air always. But in order to create this space where we could have a society and we could be professors of music theory and people could get PhDs in music theory, I think it was felt necessary to focus on that particular approach to music theory. And that's great. I mean, that did a lot of good things. But I think we're definitely in a space now where we feel secure enough that we can talk about more public-facing approaches to music theory.
Certainly, certainly. Thank you for that historization. Very complicated history, but I think it's absolutely fascinating. And so let's continue. This was penned for later in our talk here, but let's go on with that topic of professionalization or professionalism with public music theory. It's something that, as you're probably very familiar, is of a concern with public music theory. As you said, we've been in a state of relative institutional comfort at some level. Recent political stuff. But that's a whole other podcast to talk about that. Anyways, let me get back on track. The concern of professionalism or maintaining it while also allowing for a public music theory forum. I suppose I should ask you this before we get into the professionalism part, because then that gets into defining what public music theory is. And I guess I should just ask generally, because a lot of people may not have thought about it this way, but Professor Jenkins, what if you were to introduce it to a room of people, I guess you are here, what is your definition of public music theory?
I think in one of my articles that's published in the online journal Engaging Students, I think I had a definition of public music theory at that time. This was around 2016. The definition is something like it's anything that is geared to or accessible to a general audience that attempts to explain compositional process or musical output or something like that, that it's something along those lines. But I think my definition has actually broadened since then, because I was thinking at that point very much of a model of public music theory that is about professionals taking music theory and then repackaging it in some way for a more general audience. I've come to actually believe that music theory is happening all around us all of the time. I think that many people, they like the music they like, But they don't just listen to it because they like it. They also think they have questions about why they like it. And to me, those are music theoretical questions. And so I think there's public engagement with music theory in that sense happening all the time around us. And what we actually, the artifacts of public music theory that we actually know, the YouTube channels, the podcasts, the videos, the books, the many artifacts of public music theory that are captured that we actually know, those are just certain examples of what is happening over and over again on a daily basis as people engage with the music that they love.
I'm so glad. I really like that broad. I mean, I liked your original one too, but I really like your broadened one because so further than, modern art composition, which I don't like to use art music, the label, but whatever, you get it. And this podcast, my other research interest is in rap and hip hop. And I engage with, especially, it's so much fun when a new album comes out to like stay up until midnight and then you listen to it a couple times and then the next day you like listen to your favorite reactors or people on YouTube to see like the people whose opinions you care about. And it's interesting. I have caught myself, listening to these people who they would not call themselves music theorists, academics, or researchers, but like they're breaking down an analysis of a song. I'm not just talking about lyrics, but they're like, this timbre, they don't use the word timbre, but this timbre connects to this album from decades ago where these lyrics also come. And it's just like this kind of where I'm thinking, like, wow. Some of this is like conference worthy, the way that they're talking about this music, as you said, as they love. And so, okay, I wanted to take a little divot to ask what your definition of public music theory is. Now, let's circle back to that idea of professionalism. So, the positive of public music theory, one of the many, is that nearly anyone can really do it. And that's also a slight against it. Oh, there's so many different angles you could take this, but can you talk about that issue of professionalism? Who is the public music theorist and so on? And what is, there's lots of loaded things you can go with that, but what's your take on that?
Well, I think that one of the tensions in what you're talking about is the idea of quality control. In an academic environment, you have a peer review process. And for all of its flaws, one of the important roles that the peer review process plays is to improve the quality of the scholarship. Now, sometimes people don't handle that in the best way, but in an ideal form, an article should go through the peer review process and be improved. The idea should be improved, and it's part of the ways that we, as a professional field, kind of ensure the quality of what we are producing. And so I think that one of the tensions that I have experienced when I talk to people who are skeptical about public music theory or anxious about public music theory is this issue of quality and this worry that if things aren't vetted by professionals, that they won't be of a quality. And I think that part of that goes back to that earlier history I was talking about, when music theory was trying to make space for itself. At least when I was a grad student in the early 2000s at Eastman, there was a lot of in the air, there was still a lot of feeling and a lot of discussion about what things were and were not music theory. And so, anything with critical studies or anything that had to do, with critical theory or feminist thought or these kinds of things, that was. These kinds of postmodern approaches, that was absolutely not music theory. It was, at least that's how I interpreted the message that I got from the people around me. And so I think that that also plays a role here because it's this idea of like we've created this thing called music theory and we need to protect it. We need to, you know, it has to be distinct from these other things because if it's not distinct from these other things, then why do we need to exist? And so I think that there's a kind of existential concern. You know, if my students are going to YouTube to watch this video about the Circle of Fifths, then why do I need to be in front of the room teaching the Circle of Fifths? You know, so there, I think there is this existential concern that is a valid one. It's an absolutely valid one. But, you know, there have been public historians and public scientists for a long time. And that has not meant that we don't need historians or scientists. And so, of course, I embrace the idea of a very broad definition. When you talk about who is a public music theorist, I think that, as I've mentioned before, I would embrace as broad a definition of that as possible. And I would encourage the validation of people's engagement with music analytical thought at whatever stage that is. And I guess the other thing I would bring up here is the issue of terminology, because the advantage of a shared terminology is currency, right? We can exchange ideas more efficiently if we all agree what these things mean. And often, you know, people get frustrated when they think people are using the wrong term or they're using a term inaccurately. Instead of trying to get at the kernel of what it is the person is trying to say. I mean, I remember one time I was walking out of an orchestra concert and I was listening, I was eavesdropping actually to the two women in front of me, and they were talking about their reaction to the end of the piece. And I don't even remember what the piece was, but they kept saying about they were trying to describe the way the end of the piece built. And it actually built through this kind of dynamic process, this timbral and dynamic process. But they were describing it as a tempo, as a feature of the tempo, and that the piece had gotten faster and faster. And the piece actually hadn't gotten faster, but they were experiencing the change, this change, and they were trying to capture that with what the language that they had. So it would have been inappropriate for me at that point to have stepped in to them and be like, excuse me, I've overheard your thing. But really, you know, the tempo didn't change. This is what really happened. You know, that I just kind of appreciated that little moment of public music theory, getting to overhear it and thinking, you know, they definitely heard something, they experienced something, and they're trying to communicate that the best way they can with the vocabulary and the knowledge they have. And it wasn't necessary for me to like intervene, to have an intervention at that point. So, but I can understand the feelings of people who feel like that that we should have this intervention. Like we should, as professional music theorists, be trying to make all this public music theory better. I can understand that a perspective.
Yeah, attention is definitely a good way to describe that. And I certainly feel that tension as well in certain spaces. One thing, maybe this is making a straw man, but I do see this a fair amount on YouTube within. I'm not going to call out individual content creators or anything. That's unprofessional. But there's like a very within public music theory resources on YouTube or, oh gosh, Reddit. I don't even want to get started on Reddit, personally. There's like an anti-academic, nearly anti-intellectual like strain in reaction to that reaction. Almost in like the in the guard like the institutional guard of needing to have that conversation, and then people throw the baby out with the bathwater, basically, with that. How can you see, other than people calming down on both ends, how do you see that relationship be repaired between the people who are public music theorists without any institutional like connection, and then the people who, even if it starts with valid concern, are overguarded.
Yeah, one thing that I, if I can find the time to do it, an article that I would like to write is about the history of this rhetorical strategy that the public music theorist uses by distinguishing themselves from the academic music theorist or the expert, whoever that is. There is a history of that. You see it in Bernstein, you see it in Schoenberg. I'm sure that you see it earlier than that. This idea that the experts are really morons, that is just a kind of rhetorical strategy that people who want to communicate to a more general audience, they often use. And so I'd love to go back and look at that history and tease that out. So I'll say part of that, I think, is it's just rhetorical strategy. But I think it is also rooted in some truth. The truth that, certain people have experienced. And I also don't want to name particular situations, although I'm sure we can all think over the last decade of some rather famous ones. But, some things that I've done, for example, I've reached out to different content creators and tried to forge relationships with them. I've had some of them come and talk to my public music theory class. I was not involved in picking the plenary speakers, the public music theory plenary speakers that spoke at Society for Music Theory a few years ago. I was part of that panel. I wasn't involved in choosing it, but I was really gratified when Corey Arnold was asked to be part of that panel, also known as 12 Tone. And I think the more ways that we can just talk to each other, in the kind of grander scheme of things, we're all on the same side. We're all interested in the same stuff. And so I think that the opportunities that we can take as a professional society to make to reach out to people, and also on an individual basis, I've forged some really nice friendships with people just because I was like, hey, I like your stuff. Can we chat?
Sure. I understand not wanting to name certain things, but yes, we could certainly think of some aspects. About that rhetorical strategy, I'm thinking about on the history of this show with myself. I might have fallen into that once or twice. I don't really know. And and quickly before I move on, I want to say 12 Tone. Love him so much. So my background personally in music, I grew up listening almost exclusively to popular music, but I was also a violinist, but I didn't really listen to classical music that much. And it was, this sounds kind of naive, but on YouTube most of my life, it was 12 Tone's videos analyzing pop songs in a very, what I've come to learn, academic friendly way, but also very accessible way where I was like, oh, you can talk about all sorts of music. Like you talk about these other things. So 12 Tone has a special place for me. This is a fun question. This is not an accusatory question that I wanted to add. And this is connected to the, I'm thinking about my own podcast and the rhetorical traps I may or may not have fallen into. Professor Jenkins, is the theorist composer collaboration public music theory?
Well, I would say so. I mean, I was listening in preparation for today. I listened to I guess it's your most recent episode with Noriko
Yes,
Manabe,
yes.
to get a better sense. And I know you've interviewed Michael Buckler and other people that we both know. So I would absolutely say yes. It's music theorists and composers talking about music theory and composition. And you're making it public. You're putting it into a medium where anyone could access it. So by definition, I think it is. And I don't think that, just to be clear, I mean, I know you want as wide of a listenership as possible because you're putting your effort and your time into this, but I don't think we judge the quality or I don't think we judge a public music theory project, whatever it is, by the number of people that engage with it. I think that's one metric, and I think there are YouTube channels with hundreds of thousands, if not million, over 1 million subscribers that do music theory, and that is one way to say, to judge how valuable people find that project. I've also done public music theory projects with a very small segment of my local community, and that also has tremendous value. So I just wanted to kind of say that, just because something's meant for the general public, if it's not reaching hundreds of thousands of people, that doesn't mean that it's not valuable.
Well, thank you. That was a little bit of a self-gratifying question, but I wanted to ask it. And yeah, I mean, in the question that I sent to you, it's like I don't explain every idea that someone says in an episode, or if I choose to look at someone's music that I'm featuring in a specific way, like a episode a little while ago talked about topic theory. I mean, explained it a little bit, but not very in depth. Like someone in their freshman year of their undergrad probably wouldn't understand what I'm talking about. But so I just wanted to ask that. Now, here's a small caveat question. Would the identification change if I didn't have a bachelor's in music theory, a master's in music theory, and also have a pending publication and conferences and so on? I guess the answer would be no. If the output is the same, it wouldn't change it. But I'm wondering, just in an alternative universe, how my attitude would be different if I didn't have the experience and respect for the more traditional, in quotes, part of the field.
Yeah, that's probably a question better for you than for me. But I'll just say that I think you're getting at a very important issue here, which is, I struggled to find a good term for in my introduction to the Public Music Theory Handbook. I was trying to come up with a term that would encapsulate this concept of the academic music theorist, and I, one of the things I thought about was credentialed music theorist. And I think that's really what you're getting at, right? Is do you have a kind of credential? Do you have a degree that is like an imprimatur that says, you have this knowledge, right? Or do you not? And some of our really well-followed YouTube music theorists, they may have a degree in music, but very few of them are not, have master's degrees or PhD degrees. And yet they are real authorities. They have a real voice of authority for a lot of viewer listeners. And I don't think that's, to me, that's something to be celebrated. But again, there is that tension there with, why do we then need professional music theory?
Well, we could talk about public music theory for all day's end. It's so important and involves so many different parts of the field, as we've been talking about. And thank you for sharing in that. But I want to pivot a little bit to your other experiences because you have a lot under your belt. And one of them is being the president of a regional conference. Just so happens to be the regional conference that I am currently a part of, being in Tallahassee, Music Theory Southeast. And as we talked about at the very beginning, we coincidentally had breakfast together at a hotel the day before this previous Music Theory Southeast. I want to ask, what is it like running a regional conference?
Well, I think it depends on which one you're talking about.
How about yours?
Music Theory Southeast, we pretty much cover about four states, the Carolinas, Georgia, and Florida. We certainly have members from outside that are pretty faithful, but relatively speaking, we're a small regional society. Whereas, Music Theory Midwest covers a large swath of the center of the United States and Canada. So I think, running that or running MITSNS, Music Theory Society of New York State, which has its own journal. Those would be different experiences. But with Music Theory Southeast, we have one conference a year. And so a lot of the activity is around planning that conference, picking the program committee chair and the members of the program committee. That's probably one of the most important things that you do, because they then decide the program. And since that is like the highlight event of our year every year, is to meet and to have the conference, I think those decisions are the most important ones that you make. But other than that, occasionally meet with the executive board about things that might come up, make sure the society maintains some financial health. These are the main responsibilities of the president.
Yes, and I have to say, just I've only been to two Music Theory Southeast conferences. The joint one with South Central in Lipscomb, I think it was
Yeah,
in
in
Tennessee.
Nashville.
Yeah, and of course this most recent one that was in South Carolina. And it's interesting to hear you talk about the size of the conferences, because this being the only physical one, I did the online Music Theory Midwest one recently, earlier this summer, but it's a very tight-knit thing, and it's cool. I really like I say tight-knit as in a positive thing. It feels like a very large group of friends, basically.
I think that's true. I think Music Theory Southeast has always felt every year, and I have probably missed it once or twice since I started working in South Carolina, but I haven't missed it very often. And it always feels like a homecoming. And that being said, I also think that the students and faculty that come from outside the region to join us, here and there, I think they also feel very welcomed, I think, and at least I hope that's how they feel. So that is definitely a part of our vibe that I'm hoping will continue. That being said, I do think that there are ways that we can look to try to reach out and make our society more inclusive. I think one of the things that the regionals provide, there are faculty that are teaching music theory at schools across the country. They don't have travel budgets. They're not going to be able to go to the national SMT meeting. And so a regional, that maybe they can drive to and spend a couple of nights in a hotel or one night in a hotel, gives them an opportunity to remain connected to the field. Because they might be the only person teaching music theory at their school. And, in our world today, you can remain electronically connected to people in a way that we couldn't even, 10, 15 years ago. But that sense of community that you were talking about, I think that's really important when the regional societies can provide that for people that you're not going to see at a national meeting because of the financial demands that that puts on them.
Certainly, certainly. I mean, I've enjoyed my fair number of virtual conferences, but it feels like, well, obviously, quite an event when you have the privilege of going to an in-person one. And so, talking about expanding or making known, I guess expanding is a fine word, the influence and draw of Music Theory Southeast, or really any other regional conference, I'm wondering, on an administrative level, other than having the odd joint conference like with South Central, I know happens, what how do the regional conferences interact with each other?
The regional president, we meet together usually once a year, more if needed. But we had a meeting back in the fall that was really productive. I think the big issue is there. Well, there are a few big issues. One is the issue of joint conferences, when those can happen. One thing that we talked a lot about was the possibility of hybrid conferences or completely online conferences, to give people More affordable ways to participate, or for people who are not mobile, giving them ways to participate. And so that's something that we're thinking about a lot. And we've kind of set up a rotation among ourselves so that everybody knows when everybody is planning to do hybrid or online conferences, so that trying to make sure there's at least one opportunity a year within the regionals. So that's another thing. And then we're just, the group has been a good sounding board for me. I've had a couple of questions about how people handle different things. And so just kind of hearing, one was, how much do you charge for your conference? And, inflation has happened. Everything's gotten more expensive. I was worried that we might be charging too much, but then I took a poll of everybody and I realized that actually we were on the kind of lower end. So,
Yes,
yeah.
you are.
So it's a good group. The other thing that's really different, and I still don't think people realize this, but AMS has chapters. AMS is a top-down organization where they have carved the US and Canada up into chapters, and they tell the chapters what their borders are, and but with S&T, the regionals are completely autonomous from S&T. There's no official connection. S&T does provide a space for the regional presidents to talk to each other. And I think there's good relationships between S&T and the regional societies, but there is not this top-down structure. The regionals have a lot of autonomy to kind of grow and develop in the ways that they want to.
Certainly, certainly. And I just have to say, from a student or non-professor perspective, this is not a judgment call of other conferences, but Professor Jenkins, I'm going to say it is very appreciated that the conference registration fee counts as your membership fee. That is greatly appreciated. I understand other conferences have different needs depending on scale, but from a younger person's perspective, that's really cool that it's the same.
Well, at least while I'm president, I want to make sure, of course, we have to remain financially solvent, but we don't want to gouge anybody. So,
So it's
and
a
I think
balancing act.
this it relates to the inclusivity issue, right? Because you don't want a financial hardship to, you don't want that to be the reason someone doesn't participate in the organization. And I think that a couple of things that we're discussing to try to be as inclusive as we possibly can. One of the things the program committee is going to be talking about when we meet in August is considering some different presentation formats. Like maybe making posters available as an option, or lightning talks. We experimented with lightning talks a couple years ago. That seemed to be very popular. Just not assuming that the 20-minute conference paper is the only way that you can communicate your ideas. We're also going to be looking at opportunities for undergraduate students to participate in presentation, like maybe having a, I mean, I don't know, I don't want to speak for the program committee, but in preliminary discussions, we were just thinking how could we, in terms of like the pipeline in the field, how can we have a positive experience for undergraduate students that doesn't put them into the competitive process with graduate students and faculty that would be very difficult for them to be successful in? So thinking through that. And then the other thing I'm really excited about is we're going to be meeting in February at Morehouse College, which is a historically Black college in Atlanta, Georgia. And to be in the Southeast region, and for us, this will be the first time we've ever met at an HBCU. And I think that's a really important thing that we're doing. HBCUs are an important part of the academic blood of the Southeast. And so I'm really excited about the opportunity to meet there and working very closely with local arrangements. One of the things we often meet on spring break because at wherever it is at the school it is, we often meet on spring break because the facilities are free and open. And one of the things that we talked about is, could we meet during a time when the students are in class so that we can have opportunities to engage with that local community? And so I'm looking forward to some opportunities to do that.
I really appreciate your strives with that, and that dovetails into a broader question I wanted to ask about the interactions of the regional conferences and the overall zeitgeist of the field, which often, I don't know if it gets its direction or SMT is informed by it, but just the whole atmosphere of SMT and the whole field is that in recent years, let's say 10, I don't know, I don't want to quantify it totally. The field of music theory has made, in my mind, incredibly positive strides in a number of different ways, diversifying the field in attempts not only just by identity, but also in approaches in music that is considered approachable for music theoretical analysis. Earlier, you were talking about how when you were in graduate school, the postmodern approaches of critical studies and feminist studies, no, get it out here. Not at all anymore, right? We wouldn't have some of the most famous professors in the field right now if that was still the case. I'm wondering, I'm not asking for like, tell me exactly what you're going to do to fix this. I'm just wondering your thoughts about what role that regional conferences can have in furthering the a vital mission of further diversifying, decolonizing, and progressing the field of music theory in this direction that I think the field hit. Now, you can argue the peripherals of it and how it's doing, and so that's a very long debate, but point is, it's overall good, and how can regional conferences further that progress?
Yeah, I think those answers are going to probably be specific to the regions and what the needs are within those particular regions. As I've just discussed, I think we're thinking through some different ways that we can do it within our region. But when the nominating committee, so SMT or MTSE, excuse me, has a nominating committee that puts forth a ballot to the membership each year to elect members to the executive board. So I think, one thing in my role as president is I need to think careful about who's on the nominating committee, who do they represent, what kind of ideas are represented on the nominating committee, and then when the nominating committee is trying to put together a ballot, thinking through like how can we include, is everyone from the same state? Is everyone from the same school? What kind of representation do we have and what we're offering to the membership? I think thinking through all of these things are really important. And then with the program committee, they're again thinking about what kind of ideas are represented in terms of the people that make up the committee, like what are their scholarly approaches, what do they bring to the table, and just trying to make that as broad as possible so that you can let as many ideas in as possible. I think sometimes regional societies become the incubators. I mean, a lot of people do not give their first paper at the national conference, they give their first paper at a regional conference. And so in that way, the regional conferences are these incubators for ideas to bubble up and get, to more recognition. I think all of that together are ways that the regionals can really help the society move forward in that direction.
Well, thank you for your answer. It is very encouraging to hear that when you're putting together the program committee, which, as you've been kind of saying, is like it's the big moment, the whole putting together the program yearly, that you're thinking about these issues and thinking about representation of identity, of geography, and also of approach or stylistic approach. So I think it's really encouraging to hear that. I've been a big vocal champion of this, especially in the past year, that I'm going to give thanks to Professor Rachel Lumsden for this. I've shouted her out many times, but she's helped inform how I think about this a lot. When I learn about the past of music theory, I'm discouraged, but when I learn about what's coming, I'm so excited. I think this field has such amazing things recently and to come, and it's wonderful to hear from yourself that you're putting those into consideration. And I'm excited for this coming Music Theory Southeast conference up in that university is near Atlanta, is that right?
Yeah, it's in Atlanta, Morehouse College in Atlanta.
Yes, I'm very excited for that.
And I think
But
that, the other thing that both the regionals and SMT can think about is the issue of acceptance rate. I was the program chair for SMT in 2020 for the first COVID conference. And both then and then in my role at MTSE, there will always be constraints on the acceptance rate that you can only present so many things, you only have so much time. There is a quality issue. You do want to make sure, to the best of your ability, that you're putting forth, quality research for people to listen to and engage with. But that being said, I'm always a proponent of raising the acceptance rate as far as we can. And so I think having different presentation modalities allows you to use your time, maximize your time in terms of how many presenters you can have. And I know for some people, keeping a low acceptance rate is about a kind of pride of place. And it's like, well, if you get on the SMT program, that's really showing that your work is quality. I don't know. In my experience, I just remember when I was first on the SMT program committee before I chaired it. And I remember, you kind of get down and you only have so many slots you can fill, and you're getting to that very end and you're saying, like, this paper is on the program, but this paper isn't. And you kind of look at it and you're like, there's nothing wrong with this next paper, right? Like, there's no reason it couldn't be on the program, but you just run out of space. And so I would really like to see all of our conferences just try to maximize participation in that rate and not see acceptance rate as something, a low acceptance rate is not a badge of honor. I know it is for some people, but for me, I really like to see us go in a different direction.
to pivot a little bit in, I guess, our last little section to discuss. Let's talk about another part of your resume or things that you're involved in is the editor of SMTV. Now, this goes somewhat in line with your public music theory bona fides, but it is a little bit different because it's more on the academic peer-reviewed side, being part of SMT. And it's not hard to see why. I love SMTV and SMT Pod. I mentioned earlier I have a forthcoming episode in SMT Pod. Forthcoming, I don't know when, but it's coming. And also, I have a music theory podcast, so of course I love it. But what is your opinion on the place that SMTV and SMT Pod have in not just in a music public music theory sense, like not just a public facing sense, but just broadening the field in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's when you look at the history of SMT, I talked earlier about in the 70s and the 80s, this need to professionalize. But on the same at the same time, SMT had Music Theory Online in 1993. That is incredibly progressive. This idea of let's have an open access journal in 1993. So I think that the society does also have this history of trying to make information as available as possible. And I think SMTV and SMT Pod are important continuations of that strain. We as a society give away a lot of our content. We have four journals, and three of them are open. Completely open. Music Theory Online, SMTV, and SMT Pod are three publications, I should say. And so, I think that says a lot about our organization and how We're trying to make information as accessible as possible. So I do think, those are important as public music theory strides. At the same time, most of the members of SNTV, most of the members of SNT are professional academics that have tenure requirements and research venues they need to publish their research. I think it's important that these venues, as open as they are, that they maintain the peer review process that serves scholarship in general well when it's done well. And I've only been editor of SMTV since November, but I have been very encouraged by the reviews that I have seen come through. They are often very thorough, very thoughtful, sometimes critical, but not in a pejorative way. I mean, nobody likes to get a review that says anything except "Your work is brilliant. I can't wait to publish it." Like, that's the review that we all want, or at least that I want. And I admit to myself when I get those reviews, and I'm like, it just doesn't feel good for somebody to say, "You didn't do this," or "Did you think about this?" Or, but at least from my perspective as this SMTV editor, I've seen reviewers, which is all volunteer work, take their job very seriously, very thoughtfully. And one of the things that, I've edited print things before. I was an editor of Integral when I was a grad student at Eastman, and I've edited a book. And one of the things is really fun about editing SMTV that you don't get when you edit a print publication is that with a print publication, you can kind of, suggest to people different ways to word things or things like that. But when you're creating a video, you just have so much more leeway in how the information is going to get presented. And taking, I'm kind of finishing up my first videos that I've edited from the beginning to the end. And going from a proposal through a storyboard process and then into a video, I think the editor of SMTV has more opportunity to really intervene in the presentation of the scholarship than I would ever have as the editor of Spectrum. And so that is really exciting. That's been a really exciting thing. And saying to people, have you thought about presenting it this way or using this kind of visual approach? Or it's been more work than I thought it was going to be, but it's been a lot of fun.
I'm personally a huge fan of both, obviously, but I remember one thing that turned me on to SMTV that I wasn't super aware of it was I remember it's a little bit of an older one at this point, but Alyssa Barna's Dance Chorus in Top 40. Love that one. That's a great one. A little bit. I want to submit a proposal to it sometimes. Maybe you'll see it, but yeah, I have the peer review process has been wonderful over at SMT Pod. Shout out to Professor Megan Leons. She has been awesome in the group of editors, very positive environment. And I mean, it was the case before, but I've been producing podcasts for almost a year and a half, and this is my first time not only going through a peer review process, but also after having created podcasts for so long, having someone peer review something I've done for a while, it's informed how I work on this show too, a little bit. So it's incredibly valuable, not just academically, but holistically in the work that you do. So, yes, that is wonderful. And well, Professor Jenkins, we've covered quite a lot in this episode, and it's been great talking to you. And I suppose we're coming to a close here. But one thing I wanted to shout out in particular for if people want some more public music theory and some more of your writing is not too long ago, a certain Spectrum colloquy that came out. Can you talk just briefly a little bit about that?
Yeah, so a few years ago, there was a plenary session at the S&T National Conference about public music theory. And so the five speakers on this series, we transferred our spoken presentations into written presentations that were published by Music Theory Spectrum. But then the editor, Laura Emery, had the idea to have a kind of colloquy response, or not necessarily a response, but just to engage with public music theory more fully by having more people write about it. And so, yeah, it would, I have to say, it was very, very gratifying to see that volume of Music Theory Spectrum be published. I remember in 2016, I taught my first public music theory class, and I sent the syllabus to the listserv in advance of the annual meeting that year, which I think was in Vancouver, if I'm remembering correctly. But anyway, sent my syllabus out and said, "Hey, I'm teaching this class on public music theory, and I'm interested to talk to anybody at the meeting who wants to talk about this. I'm interested to talk, so let me know." Nobody reached out to say that they really wanted to chat about public music theory, but I did get people say, like, "What are you even talking about? Like, what public music theory? What even is that?" And so to go from that to like to have Spectrum, you know, to ha well, first of all, to have a plenary session about it at the national meeting, and then to have Spectrum publish a volume about it, that was really gratifying for me to see the field move in that direction.
Wonderful. And that colloquy, is it public access or open access?
I know that my article was open for a little bit of time when it first came out at the Oxford website. So Spectrum is published by Oxford University Press. So I think they opened up some of the articles for a certain period of time. I don't know if they're still open at this point.
Well, regardless, the link to it will be in the description of this episode. Even if it is not open access now, I've read all of the articles within it. I highly encourage anyone to take a look to get access to them. There are some great pieces of writing from a very diverse cast of music theorists with lots of different perspectives and very different angles of public music theory that you would not necessarily think about off the top of your head. So I highly encourage people to take a look at that for some more public music theory goodness after you're done listening to this podcast, of course. But anyways, so Professor Jenkins, in closing, what are some projects that you have coming up for yourself?
The Oxford Handbook of Public Music Theory has been online for a while. I need to get the print version out. So that would be number one. I have a few things that have been on the back burner that are filtering out. But as I am doing more administration, which I've been doing for the last year and a half as an associate dean, that does mean less time for my own particular scholarship. So I'm putting a lot of my energy in terms of music theory on editing SMTV over the next year, two, and I guess I have another 2.5 years editing that. So a lot of my energy will actually be in, you know, making sure SMTV is as good as it can be and getting those videos out. I mentioned earlier that my master's degree is in music theory and composition, and I've actually been composing more as of late. Had a couple of commissions that came through, and that was really exciting. So, you may in the future hear more about me through composition than music theory. It just remains to be seen.
Well, either way, I'd love to have you back on to feature a piece. I just a quick shout out as well about your composer side. And one of the best things that I saw at this most recent SMT meeting was the composer theorist concert. Love that. And you wrote a phenomenal fugue, by the way, for that. So, yeah, wonderful. Great to hear that. And what would be the best way for people to contact you with any comments or questions?
You can email me at DannyJenkins@sc.edu.
Wonderful. And that will be in the description of this episode, regardless of where you're listening. And final question, Professor Jenkins, if you were to add anything else to this conversation or surmise anything, music theory, composition, public music theory, whatever it may be.
I guess the last thing I would say is that I think with public music theory, we often think about things that are directed at a very wide general audience. You know, the people we celebrate, like Leonard Bernstein, have reached millions of people. And I think it's important to not forget that public music theory can also mean engagement within your local community. And that's how I've spent most of my efforts in public music theory, working with the aged population. I've worked with the homeless population. I've worked with the incarcerated population here in the state of South Carolina. And so I just want to remind people to think about public music theory in the broadest way they can, and to think about there are often ways that you can use your musical knowledge and skills in order to improve people's lives. And so just be on the lookout for those in your own communities.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you, Professor Danny Jenkins, for coming on to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. It's been wonderful to talk to you, talk about these large spanning and very important issues. Thank you for your time and thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Aaron. Have a good day.
Hello, this is Aaron again, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Theorist Composer Collaboration. I also want to give another big thank you to Professor Danny Jenkins for coming onto the podcast. Professor Jenkins' contact info is listed in the description, and I would appreciate it if you could show him some support. For further updates and notifications on the Theorist Composer Collaboration, make sure to follow our Instagram and Facebook pages. You can listen to future episodes through our host website, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, iHeartRadio, and YouTube. So make sure you subscribe to the platform of your choosing. If you want to monetarily support the work of the TCC, you could click the link to our Buy Me a Coffee page. All donations are highly appreciated. All of the relevant links to follow, listen to, and support the show are in the description. TCC episodes are posted every other week on Mondays, and don't miss our blog posts, which go live a few days before a new episode is added. Make sure to follow our social media accounts and relevant streaming platforms because you won't want to miss it. But until then, this is Aaron, and thank you for joining the TCC.